sports, entertainment, and Maine's best guest list on The Pulse, AM 620 WZON, WZONThePulse.com, and the WZON app. This is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
This is really a love story, an affair twixt a town and a team, a town that had waited and waited for what seemed an impossible dream. Here's the pitch, and Scott hits one deep into center field. This one is back. This one is gone. The story had its beginning under the Florida sun. The odds makers looked them over and said 100-1. But the team had a sort of a new look, a new manager stepping in, and he taught them a baseball lesson. It's much more fun to win. They came north to Frosty Fenway and won their opening game. And the fans began to sense it. This year was not quite the same.
Well, of course, fans of a certain age will recognize that as the great Kenny Coleman from the Impossible Dream album that looked back on one of the most remarkable seasons in the history of New England sports, the 1967 Boston Red Sox. Yes, those 100-1 shots that won the whole thing, except for the World Series. That was an afterthought, though, for fans of New England who had not enjoyed a World Series appearance since 1946, when Ted Williams got his only shot at a World Championship. In our special program today, we look back 50 years to that impossible dream season. We talk with some reporters, their memories of the game, authors who've written wonderful books about the 1967 season, and even a couple of players who were part of those cardiac kids, the 1967 Boston Red Sox. We begin with the longest tenured broadcaster in Red Sox history and a guy who is in many ways the unofficial historian of the team, member of the Red Sox Hall of Fame, Joe Castiglione.
It's the most important year, Rich, I think, in Red Sox history, because this was a moribund franchise. I mean, Fenway Park was a disaster. The ball club was terrible. They drew 500,000, 600,000 fans. You know, they dropped the 50s. They were pretty bad, and they did have Ted. And then, of course, Yaz came along, and he wasn't quite the same attraction. But I think it was about all they had. So I think you really have to look at that and realize that this club might have been in big trouble. In fact, if the Braves had stayed a couple of more years, it might have been the Red Sox who left town.
Mm.
The Braves had Eddie Matthews, they had Hank Aaron, Lawrence Bond. That's one of the top 10 teams, Red Sox, in baseball history, those Braves teams from, say, 1956 through 59. So that's why 67 was so important. I mean, the Red Sox came along, and the impossible dream, and it really ignited the franchise.
Yes, had such a great year with the Triple Crown, but the numbers don't begin to tell the story. And we know what David Ortiz did in those so-called clutch situations, but can you recall anybody having that kind of success in pressure situations that Yaz had throughout that 67 campaign?
Only Ortiz. I think Cincinnati fans might look at Tony Perez in his prime, but it was uncanny what he did. 4-for-4 in the final game. I mean, to win the Triple Crown, and everything that Carl did was just in the spotlight. One of the great pennant races, a 14 race, right down to the wire, till after actually the last game for the Red Sox was completed, because they had to wait around to see if the Tigers lost to the Angels or whether they had a playoff. So it brought the franchise back. It woke them up, and it's continued ever since.
And when you look at any successful team, there are always role players that have outstanding years and fill those key positions. And I look back at guys like Jose Santiago, Lee Stang, Dalton Jones, Mike Andrews, guys who really had unexpectedly good seasons.
Yeah, Mike Andrews was a young player. He came up the year before and been a shortstop in the minors. Second base, remember, Reggie Smith started opening day. And Mike came on, won the job, and had some big hits and solidified the infield along with his buddy Rico Petrocelli. And those two later became a great team with the Jimmy Fund together in their post-playing careers. Santiago came from Kansas City. He wasn't a huge winner. And he ends up starting first game of the World Series and loses 2-1, hits a home run off Gibson. And, of course, Lee Stang. There were just so many unsung guys. Jerry Adair was a big, big factor with key hits. And when you win, you have to have contributions like that from people of that ilk.
No team likely as important as the 04 championship team that broke the long streak, but is that 67 team maybe as high as number two on the list, at least in modern history?
Oh, I think so. And, you know, you might even put it up there in some ways over 04 because that's where it started. I mean, it might not have been a Boston Red Sox franchise that had not been for 67 the way they were going from, say, the mid-50s through the mid-60s. But no question about it, Rich. This was such a pivotal year. And, of course, I wasn't in Boston at the time. I was a college student. First game I ever saw was at Fenway Park in 1967. August of that year, I stood in the center field bleachers, which actually were bleachers. There were bench seats. And that was the first time I'd ever gone to Fenway. I remember the Red Sox lost that night to the Washington Senators, despite a Yaz homer. And that was quite a thrill. And it's all taken off in there. But when I came to Boston, I mean, Ken Coleman, loved that team. He was the impossible dream record, and Ken talked about it constantly. And that really ingrained in me how important that year was.
That's Joe Castiglione here as Downtown remembers the impossible dream Red Sox. Another guy who remembers was there for a lot of those exciting games as a fan before he began work for the Boston Globe, the great Bob Ryan.
Dick O'Connell was brought on, hired on the 16th of September, 1965, the day that Dave Moorhead pitched his no-hitter. And he actually stole the headlines because he had taken over from the longtime crony and drinking buddy of Yawkey, Mike Higgins. And people didn't know a whole lot about Dick O'Connell. He wasn't a baseball purist guy. He had come from a different background, although, you know, he had then entered into baseball. But people didn't know much about him and the outside world. And he engineered a lot of things that made 67 happen. Made some important deals during the course of the season, a big trade near the trading deadline to bring in Gary Bell. Later picked up Jerry Adair, picked up Elston Howard, and these were all instrumental in it. And he provided the stability to the organization that lasted. And yes, he is not as well remembered as he should be.
Dick Williams, certainly and deservedly so, gets a lot of credit, mostly for bringing in a new attitude to this team, starting with his opening statement as manager.
Remember that their reputation was this was the country club team. Tom Yawkey was a paternalistic owner, loved his players too much, and had favorites, Ted and Yaz and a few others. And liked to play in the, you know, he played Pepper when they were on the road, and he hung out in the clubhouse a lot, which owners say or, you know, simply don't do. But all in all, produced a comfort level that was not warranted by their W's and L's. And Dick Williams came in and cleaned house. He came in as a drill sergeant and immediately changed the but they weren't using this phrase then, Rich, but what he did was he changed the culture and ahead of his time. Absolutely made the famous proclamation, we'll win more than we lose, which people scoffed at. And now in retrospect, of course, we now have to be reminded that they were actually pretty good in the second half of 66. They had the second best record in the American League after the All-Star break, although it only got them up to ninth place instead of 10th. But still, I didn't really think about that too much until years ago, about several years ago when a friend of mine pointed it out. But no one believed that there was any relevance to him saying they were, or any credibility, him saying we're going to win more than we lose. No one expected anything out of that team. And as we all know, it provided us with one of the great, well, one of the great pennant races, but for many of us, and I'll put my hand up right here, the greatest fan experience I ever had, be it high school, college, or professional, was rooting for the 67 Red Sox.
Bob Ryan with us here on Downtown. Carl Yastrzemski these days is one of the most beloved players in Red Sox history, but what people forget is that going into that 67 season, he was under so much pressure and viewed by a lot of people, despite the batting title in 63, as a disappointment as, well, anybody would be following Ted Williams out in left field.
It wasn't easy to follow Williams. He followed him directly. He was a rookie in 61. And you're right, he did win that one batting title, but he was a doubles hitter. They thought he was moody. There were some issues. He was an excellent fielder, but he was a singles and doubles hitter. And then we all know the story. It's a stuff of mythology, but it happens to be true that in the summer of 66, 67, he made a policy decision to try to upgrade his level. And he decided he needed to get in better shape. And he hired a Hungarian expatriate named Gene Birdie, B-E-R-D-E, up at the Colonial Country Club in Linfield, Mass., to be a personal trainer. And he put Yaz through a winter of rigor and maybe one of hell. And he came in the best shape of his life. And the second thing is, he decided he was going to pull the ball. And I don't know whether he got help from Ted or not, because Ted was always there as an instructor in spring training. But he began to pull, and that was evident from the start. And he wound up upping his homer total to 44, and became for the rest of his life became a pull hitter who really went up with over 450 homers. That was not in the cards entering the 67 season. He was 28 years old. And he turned 28 on August 22nd, 67, and who knew that he was going to last 16 more years? By the way, turning on fastballs as late as his final at-bat or his final week, when I saw it happen, he was actually still taking extra batting practice the last week of the 83 season, because he was determined that he was going to retire without people saying he couldn't turn on a fastball.
The golden boy of that team was, of course, the local boy, Tony Conigliaro, who went down on that fateful night in August on the pitch from Jack Hamilton. How good was Tony Conigliaro?
On his way to 500, maybe 600 home runs. He was only 22 years of age. He already was the first guy in the American League to hit 100 home runs before 20. I think the only other guy was Millot. And he had won the home run title in 65. Was at the time of he got hit on August 18th, 20 homers, 67 ribbies, was maybe as good a clutch hitter as Yaz that year, even though Yaz got more publicity for it, and was on his way to a golden career. And of course, Fenway, he was made to hit in Fenway. He hit fly balls, not line drives, and of course, Fenway was made for that. And he was a good fielder, and of course, he was the ultimate local boy makes good, living at home, and it was a pop celebrity guy. He had a hit record, not a local hit, a two-sided hit, playing the field in Little Red Scooter. I have one. I bought it. And, you had to have it, just like you had to have Yaz bread
right
that year, that summer. I was there that night, Rich. I was in the box seat down the third baseline. I got a foul ball in the first inning, the only one I ever got in the stands.
Wow.
Jimmy Hall popped one up, and it rolled right under my seat. I didn't even have to move or fight anybody. And anyway, I was there that night, and it was a bizarre, surreal night. Believe me, a strange, strange game. Overall, and of course, highlighted or lowlighted by Tony C getting hit.
And they would not have had the success they had without the work of the guy known as Gentleman Jim Lomborg, with a 22-win season, really a season for the ages, won the Cy Young Award, won the pitching Triple Crown that year. And while he'd been a pretty solid pitcher, that was an unexpected season.
No, it was. He was a 9-17 at one year. He was he went to Venezuelan League, some winter league, and he started pitching inside a little bit. Then he got the gospel preached to him by the infamous or the famous or the wonderful, whoever, Sal the Barber Magley, who was the pitching coach.
Right.
And he, of course, was known for, he got his nickname because he gave close shaves to batters. And once it was said of him, he would throw his grandmother. Oh, that was early win. I don't want to get him confused. But he was, nonetheless, he was famous for being a ruthless competitor and a guy who would pitch inside. And he preached that gospel to Lomborg. Lomborg, in his first two full seasons, hit 19 guys. That year, he hit 21. And as he points out, 20 of them unintentionally. Of course, the one famous one was in New York Yankee Stadium in June when he hit that Tillotson, and as they were embarked on a beanball war that night that had actually started the night before. And But he'll tell you all about the fact that he certainly did throw that ball at Tillotson, and all hell broke loose, and that was a fun night in Yankee Stadium.
Bob, what was your favorite moment of that 67 season?
Well, of course, October 1, being out in the stands on October 1 and being there for the whole experience of it. I went to 27 games that year, and there were some wonderful ones, of course, but the one you'll always remember is the October 1st, and it's starting with a bunt in the sixth inning. He leads off the sixth, Lomborg does. Now, in the National League, without a DH, he wouldn't even, in today's game, he'd never bat in that sixth inning, down 2-0 in the sixth. But he was down 2-0 in the sixth, and he leads off with a bunt. And then it goes right, a banana on it goes. Jerry Adair hits one up the middle. I can still see Rod Carew, the rookie second baseman, diving to his right, but not able to knock it down. Then Dalton Jones hits one in through the hole, through the Tony Gwynn 4.5 hole. And now the bases are loaded, and Yaz is up. And if there was ever a thing we could all be sure of in our lifetime, it was that Yaz was getting hit at that moment. And he ripped the shot up the middle for two runs, and the inning continued on with crazy stuff, and they wound up getting five runs. Then if we get to the eighth inning, and the Twins get a run, and they got a run in, and when Bob Allison doubled into the corner to drive in a run, but then he made the fatal mistake. He tried to take second. Yaz threw him out. And Tommy, I always remember watching Tony Oliva look out at second base, staring at Allison, fuming at Allison. And 1999, when we had the All-Star game and we had the 50 greatest, all the 100 greatest players here, they had a wonderful affair, and many affairs at Fenway. And I was able to speak to Oliva, and I said, I got to ask you something. I said, on October 1, 67, when Allison was thrown out at second base, and I can still see you standing, staring at him. What were you thinking? And he looks at me after a long pause and says, with gritted teeth, that was a long time ago. So that was your answer. That was your answer, folks.
Do you still have the scorecard from that game?
I certainly do. It's framed on my wall in my office. In the scorebook, I was using a big, big scorebook in those days. And I'll have to be honest, the one you see, if you were to come to my office at home, is a recopied, neat one from the original. But it's the exact scoring that was done that game. But I recopied it, and it's framed with these ticket stubs from the box seat that my wife and I, my girlfriend then, my current wife of 48 years, and I think probably the everlasting one. I use the word current, but I think that doesn't mean she's on probation. So I think we're going to make it to the finish line.
Bob Ryan here on Downtown as we salute the 1967 Boston Red Sox. Straight ahead, Gordon Eads and author Ray Sinibaldi.
Worried about buying a pre-owned vehicle? Experience the pre-owned difference with Quirk Auto Group. Every pre-owned vehicle from Quirk comes with a Carfax Vehicle History Report, a Quirk Certified Pre-Owned Inspection, a 3-month, 3,000-mile limited warranty, and state inspections for the life of the vehicle. That's the Quirk Pre-Owned difference. Experience it for yourself at more than 10 statewide locations. It's your car. Find it at Quirk, QuirkAuto.com. Wholesale vehicles excluded from the 3-month, 3,000-mile limited warranty and main state inspections.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Dunnett Appliance and Mattress has been family-owned and operated since 1948, selling all major brands of appliances. Stop in at 63 Washington Street, Penobscot Plaza, Bangor, and find out about the Dunnett's Advantage. At Dunnett's, they'll price match any local competitor, and they also offer special financing options. Of course, Dunnett's services what they sell with their own parts and service department, and they offer free delivery to most areas. Come on into Dunnett's, 63 Washington Street in Bangor, and see the difference you get with a local, family-owned and operated business. Dunnett's has done it again.
Green Acres Kennel Shop is your pet's home away from home. In fact, Green Acres has been voted the best kennel in the Bangor region every year since 2002 and one of the top 15 kennels in New England in 2016. With award-winning and knowledgeable staff and owners that live on site, you can be confident your pet is in good hands. Not only does Green Acres provide top-notch boarding for your dogs and cats, but they have also been voted the Bangor area's best pet groomer, dog trainer, and best pet store for the past several years. Located conveniently at 1653 Union Street in Bangor, make Green Acres Kennel your pet's home away from home. Visit them online today at greenacreskennel.com for more information or call them at 945-6841. Don't forget to ask about their rewards and frequent buyer programs.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person and online at slippinggears.com.
Swinging a high drive deep center, looking up, this ball is gone! The Red Sox win it!
Hear every inning of every Red Sox game all season long on AM 620, The Pulse. Brought to you locally by JR Redemption Center. Remember, recycling makes sense at JR Redemption Center, 151 South Main Street, Brewer. CU Promise Loans, home loans for Maine. Online at CUPromise.com. Jackson Plumbing and Heating, your family source for a clean, safe, and energy-efficient System 2000 boiler. Call 827-7042. And Blackbeard's Family Fun Park. Go-karts, miniature golf, batting cages, arcade, and snack bar. Audland Road, Bangor.
Hanley hopping on third base. Throws the helmet away, and he will be piled on at home plate.
Join the voice of the Red Sox, Joe Castiglione, and Tim Neverett all season long as the Red Sox push for the postseason. Catch every Red Sox game on AM 620, The Pulse.
Can you believe it?
When he took over as manager, Dick Williams made a promise.
The only thing I can tell you right now, I'll guarantee you we'll have a hustling ball club, and they won't quit. They didn't quit on me in Toronto. I don't intend to have anybody quit on me here.
And the young leader also made a prediction.
I honestly think we'll win more ballgames than we lose.
Well, Dick Williams was absolutely correct. They did win more than they lost, and a lot of that was because of his work. We talked about the management of the team, the players, and memories of 67 with longtime sports writer, current Boston Red Sox historian, Gordon Eads.
To me, it's pretty obvious what the appeal of 67 is and remains. To me, I think you can point at maybe two seasons in Red Sox history in the last 50 years that are transitional years. One is 1967, which I think you can directly trace the birth of what we now know as Red Sox Nation. And the other is 2004, when in the course of a single calendar day, David Ortiz changed the narrative of this story from ultimate losers to improbable winners. And, three World Series titles later, here we are. But, I mean, think back to the 60s and where the Red Sox were. Ted had retired in 1960. Having finished his career without ever having won a World Series, only went once in 46, and he was hurt and only had one single in seven games. And he had five singles in seven games, and it was a profound disappointment for him. And the Red Sox of the 60s were a terrible ball club. Attendance didn't crack a million from 1961, which is a year after Ted retired, through 1966, and with the exception of a few bright lights like Carl Yastrzemski and the local kid Tony Conigliaro and the monster Dick Raddatz, there wasn't very much compelling about this team, and they played bad baseball. In 1966, they finished in ninth place, 26 games out of first. And there was very little reason to feel particularly optimistic. And I think the indifference to the Red Sox extended all the way up to the owner's suite, where Tom Yawkey was actually making noises about either having a new ballpark built, which he claimed, and isn't that a familiar refrain, or even, you know, God forbid, moving the ball club. As my friend Bob Ryan recently said, there were some people who were saying the wrong team left.
Right.
Boston, you know, the Braves left in 53 and won back-to-back, or went to the World Series in back-to-back years in 57 and 58, winning in 57. And here the Red Sox were just a very mediocre ball club. And 1967 changed all of that. You know, 100-1 long shots, winning on the last day of the season in what was the most dramatic pennant race in history. Yeah, there's no question there are compelling reasons that people continue to look fondly at 67. I'll tell you this, Rich. I covered all three World Series titles, as you know, for the Globe and ESPN. And 1967 still, for me, remains my all-time favorite Red Sox season. And I think part of that is because it was in the wheelhouse of my youth, as it is was for so many people who still look so fondly on that year. And I think it was such a young team, and a superstar in Yastrzemski, who had an unmatched season in 67. I mean, think about it. The numbers they barely scratched the surface of Yastrzemski's performance in 67, which I know is saying a lot considering he won the Triple Crown. But forget about the 320-plus batting average and the 44 home runs and the 121 RBIs and all. It seemed like regardless of when you turned on the radio, if the team needed a great catch, Yaz made the catch. If they needed a great throw, he made the throw. If they needed a home run, he got the hit. If they needed seven hits in the last eight at-bats over the final weekend of the season, Carl Yastrzemski did that, too. It was unlike – to me, it was the equivalent of the Marvel superheroes that the kids watch today. You know, Yaz was our superhero in 1967.
There's no question about it. And for younger fans, talk about pressure. I mean, today, look, you got wild card teams, and if you're a decent team, you got a pretty good shot of getting in, and then anything can happen. But going into that final weekend of 67, they had to win because only one team from the entire American League would make it, and you had four of them in contention for that one spot right till the bitter end.
Well, and that's why you can't. We will never see that pennant race duplicated. You know, not under the playoff format that we now have. It was you know, winner take all, and everybody else go home. And for the Sox who have come into that final weekend, not only it wasn't even enough that they beat Minnesota in both of those games, which they absolutely had to do to even have a chance. Then they're gathered around a radio in the Sox clubhouse after that Sunday afternoon game, waiting for the outcome of the Tigers Angels game, and talk about a more innocent time, Rich. Right?
Oh yeah, listening to the call of Ernie Harwell, right?
Exactly, as opposed to getting you know, updated text messages and tweets and God knows what else. And certainly the game would have been on television. They'd have been watching on TV or online instead of gathered around that radio. But, you know, there are a couple things that really stand out to me about that team as well. And one is how impossibly young that group was. By my count, 18 players were 25 years of age or younger on that Red Sox club. I mean, you go around the infield, I don't think there was an infielder older than 24 between George Scott and Mike Andrews and Rico Petrocelli and Joe Foy. Yes, it was only 27. I think Lomborg was only 25. So I think that was part of the reason people fell so hard for this club. They seem to be these young, fearless overachievers who just you couldn't help but be captivated by them.
Gordon, in your role, either as a reporter covering the team through the years or now as the Red Sox historian, when you talk to members of that 67 team, do they look back on it as fondly as the fans do?
That's a great question, and that's the first time. You know, I've been talking a lot about 67, as you can well imagine, and you're the first person who's actually framed the question that way. And I can tell you, when in listening to Rico and Mike Andrews and Jim Lomborg, and I actually had the opportunity to sit down with Yaz for 40 minutes in an interview that will probably air on NESN sometime next month. 67 occupies a special place in their lives, too. And I don't think any of them experienced anything really that you could remotely compare to 67. I know 75, that epic World Series, and Yaz having a chance to be the hero there in Game 7, and then again making the final out in that one-game playoff in 78. I suppose those experiences would rival 67. But again, to me, for the players, given their youth, it was much the same as it was for those of us who were young fans at the time. You know, the first time is the time you're going to remember most fondly. I think that's as true as much for those players as it is for us.
Well, we had a chance this morning to talk with Billy Rohr, who had that memorable performance against the Yankees in April of that year, and you can still hear the joy in his voice as he looks back on that.
You know, I hope he told you the story he told me a couple years ago when I called him, and we talked about how Jackie Kennedy and her son, John Jr., were in the stands for that game. And after the game, Jackie requested that security bring John and herself down to the dugout because John wanted to meet Billy Rohr. And as Rohr tells it, what Rohr said was, you know, John asked me for my autograph. He said, if I was thinking, I should have asked him for his. His would have been worth a hell of a lot more than mine was.
I love it. That's great. Well, Gordon, we really appreciate you sharing some memories of this incredibly memorable 67 team. Hard to believe 50 years has passed, but it's great to look back and think about what a thrill that whole summer was.
Oh, you know, and I'll tell you what, it for me, it still transports me to a sweeter time. It really does. Whenever I watch any footage of 67, and I can't help but smile. It's a beautiful thing.
That's Gordon Eads here on the Best of Downtown as we remember the impossible dream Red Sox. When we come back, with a guy who wrote the book on the team, author Ray Sinibaldi, next on Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Wherever you're headed this time of year, G&M Family Market is the place to go to begin your journey. With fresh produce delivered every day, a great selection of meats and seafood, and delicious pre-made meals, G&M has what you're looking for with lots of great specials in the flyer and on the website. And if there's something you're looking for and G&M doesn't have it, they'll make every effort to stock it for your next visit. With the Dunkin' Donuts and Amato's right on site, G&M is your go-to place this holiday season and year-round. Open 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. every day of the week on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
The pennant, just an impossible dream. For Boston had watched and waited 21 frustrating years while April's high aspirations turned to September's tears. But on the bench, manager Williams refused to sing the blues. He made one promise only: we'll win more than we lose. At times, he seemed mistaken. The team had hit the skids, but they sounded attack and came battling back. They call them the Cardiac Kids.
McLaughlin ready. The pitch to Foy. Line toward left field deep. And it is up there for a home run. Tony, in this ball game, has fouled to the catcher, singled to center, and reached second in the seventh on a two-base throwing error by Fregosi, who took his ground ball and threw it into the Boston dugout. 5-4, California. Here's the pitch. Line toward left field deep, and it is tied up.
The Tigers came back. They had the lead going into the ninth inning by a run, but Diaz tied it up, and we're now in the tenth. Dalton Jones up against Marshall. Jones wraps one deep toward right. It's up, and it is gone. Home run upper deck for Dalton Jones. The Red Sox take the lead.
One ball, no strikes to toehead Jerry Adair. Reggie Smith representing the winning run at third. Crowd anxious on every pitch. Rojas wants another sign. Leans in. Gets it. Winds. Fires. Ground ball. Hit the third. It's past third base into left field. And Reggie Smith scores the winning run.
We're back on Downtown Salute to the 1967 Red Sox. And let's talk to the guy who wrote the book on that season. Author Ray Sinibaldi, his book is The 1967 Red Sox, The Impossible Dream Season.
It's really amazing that as I was researching my book on 67, and I chose the Quincy Patriot Ledger as my source, if you will, because everybody does the Globe and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to be a little bit more local, having grown up in Weymouth, which is right next door to Quincy. So anyway, I looked at it, and I'm reading these things that Yawkey is basically saying. If we don't get some help rebuilding Fenway for a new park, it's an old, dilapidated ballpark, then I can see me moving the team out of the city. I mean, it really, and that was in June. Okay, that was in June of 67, those articles were appearing. But the beauty of the latter half of that year is they actually played over 500 by a few games after the All-Star break. So they had all those kids kind of were coming up and making a, you know, George Scott was in place. Obviously, Tony C was there. Yaz was there. In 1967, Yaz was the old man at 27. He was the oldest member of the starting nine at 27. So all these other kids, 22, you know, Smith and Andrews and all those guys that came in 67, 22, 23 years old. You had Scott, you had Foy, you know, and Canigliano was still just a kid. So all of it kind of meshed in, and the latter half of 66, they looked pretty good. They looked, I think they finished maybe the latter half looked like they were 43-40 or something like that, after, as you just said, having been abysmal for as long as they were. That was the worst stretch of preseasons that they had had since before Yawkey bought the team in the 30s.
Well, a lot of that changed, too, with a key hiring going into the 67 season as they brought up Dick Williams from the minor leagues, who made a promise that seems pretty tame now, but at the time people thought he was crazy for suggesting it.
Yeah, I honestly think we'll win more than we lose. You know, they won't quit on me. They didn't quit on me in Toronto, and I don't expect to have anybody quit on me here. He was 36 years old. And having finished his career with the Red Sox in 1964. So it was absolutely a perfect fit. And, you know, he took the captaincy away from Yaz, and everybody went, oh, my goodness. But it was perfect because Yaz didn't want any part of that nonsense anyway. So it all worked out. It worked out and worked out perfectly. And he was the guy. I mean, you know, it's like, it's just interesting how serendipity works. Just guys get together and some energy gets created. And I think that happens more in baseball than anything else, you know. And it's kind of downplayed these days. Although Theo's trying to bring it back, talking about looking for clubhouse guys, guys that have, you know, that the positive energy, and you know, we're so locked into sabermetrics and what's measurable and all that stuff. And there is just things in the game of baseball that are immeasurable. You cannot measure them. And that was kind of, I think, what he created there with all that. All that energy and all that, as for lack of a better term, they call it chemistry. I refer to it as energy. And it all worked out wonderfully for all of us who got to live it.
We're talking with Ray Sinibaldi. His book is 1967 Red Sox, The Impossible Dream Season. And in the book, Ray, you give a lot of credit, and rightly so, to general manager Dick O'Connell. They had been through a stretch with Joe Cronin, with Mike Higgins, a couple of stints as the manager where it was the whitest team in baseball, as you note in the book, the last team to integrate with Pumpsy Green. Right. But some of the keys to this 67 team were those African-American ball players that O'Connell brought in.
No doubt. You know, George Scott, Joe Foy, went and got Johnny Wyatt. I mean, he just, when O'Connell came in, O'Connell looked for baseball players. That's all there was to it. You know, he looked for baseball players. You know, Mike Higgins went on record as saying that there will never be, and I won't use the word, one of those that'll be in this team as long as I'm the manager. I mean, as far back as in the late 50s, Billy Mombouquet basically called him out and said, I hear you use that word again, I'm going to punch your lights out. But O'Connell was looking for baseball players, and, you know, as you just said, Rich, it was, you know, the Boomer was terrific in 1967. Joe Foy, key hit, key RBIs, you know, played a great third base. Johnny Wyatt was unbelievable out of the bullpen. Jose Tartable with the famous throw, throwing out Ken Berry at the plate in that game in Chicago. You know, it goes on and on and on. So it was the right group, the right guys, in the right place at the right time. Good stuff.
Now, we got some signs that it was going to be a very special season in April of that year, thanks to a guy who you got to write the foreword for your book, Billy Rohr.
Yeah, Billy Rohr. You know, I got to tell you, what a gracious guy he is, too. And I'm so glad that I chose him, because when I was looking, I said, you know, everybody thinks of 67, they think of, you know, what do you think of? You think of Yaz, you think of Lawbrook, you think of all of those guys. And I said, you know, this guy opened the portal, if you will, for lack of a better phrase. And, you know, that night, that day, that afternoon at Yankee Stadium, you know, he had two wins, Rich, and he had that one win, two wins with the Red Sox. That was one of them. He shut the Yankees out. He was throwing a shutout a week later at Fenway against the Yankees. And late in the game, it might have been the eighth, or he might have been at the top of the ninth, Elston Howard singled in a run to break up the shutout, and he beat him 6-3. I think he won that game 6-1, and that was it. He pitched 45 innings for the Red Sox in 1967. But he is a name that is as remembered as any of those guys. And when I asked him if he would write the foreword, it was funny. I sent him an email, and I received word within probably a half hour. I got an email back, and I got a phone call, and he said he would love to do it. And just what a great, great guy. And he loves it. He revels in it. You know, he refers to it as his 15 minutes. and, you know, in that season where every single win was absolutely monumental, there was no such thing as a minor contribution on that team. And his was as, his was as significant as anybody.
Absolutely. The team got very hot on a road trip in July, and that's when things really began to heat up for the fans, because much to the team's surprise, they got back to Logan Airport after a road trip, and the place was packed with fans.
Yeah, there was 15,000 at Logan, and they were swarming. And actually, you know, Dick Williams deserves a lot of credit, too, for this, because they were on the buses, and they're looking, and they're all figuring out, well, how do we get around this? You know, what are we going to do? How can we get around this? How can we avoid this? And Dick Williams said, listen, these people came out to see us. Let's just go. Let's just go. Whatever's going to happen, it's going to happen. They came to see us. Let's just ride through it, and let's just see what happens. And, of course, it was, you know, Teddy Coleman wrote, Rich, about 1967, and I'm paraphrasing, and I think I might have quoted him somewhere in the book, but he talked about the few times in our lives that we get to experience a collective joy, that you get this incredibly bountiful, joyful experience that is shared by countless people around you. That was one of those. That night at Logan Airport was one of them. Of course, the next one came in Kenmore Square on the last day of the season, which I was am ever so grateful that I got to be a part of it. I was at that game with my dad. So it was pretty cool.
Now, between those two highlights, though, there was a dark night in August when Jack Hamilton of the Angels drilled Tony Conigliaro. And people forget, because of Yaz and his Hall of Fame career and the Triple Crown, that as good as Yaz had been, Tony was the most popular guy on that team, being the local kid.
No doubt. And this, you know, it's funny. I was speaking with somebody about Conigliaro just over the weekend. And, you know, Tony's story is just, I mean, it's, you know, it speaks for itself. But I am absolutely convinced, Rich, that if William Shakespeare were to crawl out of the grave today and visit America, and he went and watched some baseball, that he would say, you know what, I like this game, and I need to write about it. Give me a tragic hero, and it would be Tony Conigliaro.
Yeah.
You know, no doubt about it. And, of course, he was so unbelievably clutch. And he was in the midst of a very, very good year, already having been the youngest guy to lead the league in home runs. You know, already have been the second youngest player to reach 100 home runs in the history of baseball. And as you hit on it, the local kid, born in East Boston, raised in Swampscott. I mean, go on and on and on. And he was a player. And that night, you know, the irony of all of that is, I mean, Ted Williams had talked to his agent. His agent was actually down in the Lake Village. Ted baseball camp one time, and Ted Williams had actually said to him, he said, listen, make sure you tell him he's got to get off the plate. He said, he's hanging a little bit over that plate a little bit too much. He said, they're going to get him. And, you know, obviously, whether he got the word and ignored it or never got the word, obviously that night changed it all for him. You know, that great line by Kenny Coleman in The Impossible Dream, one August night, the kid in right place falling in the dirt. The fastball struck him square. He found his Tony badly hurt. I mean, and, you know, obviously it was the beginning of the end for what I think, when he passed away, he should have been at the end of a Hall of wrapping up the end of a Hall of Fame career as a designated hitter.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about that. Now, they brought in Ken Harrelson, and that was another one of those great moves that Dick O'Connell made, from Elston Howard to Jerry Adair to Ken Harrelson. He just made all the right moves, bringing in those role players.
No doubt. Well, you know, he got Adair and Gary Bell right at the trade. The trading deadline was in June then. He got Adair and Gary Bell then. Brought up Gary Wasluski then as well. He came up and joined the staff in June. And then Elston Howard in August. And then Harrelson, God bless Charlie Finley. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, all that nonsense. And all of a sudden, he becomes the first free agent. Filled in very nicely for the end of the year. Again, he didn't do a whole heck of a lot. But I think he had three or four home runs, but obviously was a threat with the bat that could replace Tony's threat with the bat. He wasn't as good as he was, but he certainly was good enough. And again, all those chess pieces, all just moving. You know, serendipity is a beautiful thing.
Well, and then we come to the guy who stole the show, won the Triple Crown, and was the hero of that season. The numbers are great, but the numbers don't tell the story of what Kar Yastrzemski did in that Impossible Dream season. And I think of the line, and I believe it was Ned Martin, that I still recall from that Impossible Dream album, where he said, if you just tuned in, he's done it again. And that was the story of that season, night after night.
You know, it's funny, Rich, to say that, and it's very interesting. When David Ortiz, when the Red Sox won in 2004, my son was in college. And I always described Yastrzemski, you know, how could he used to say to me, Dad, what was it like? What was Yaz like in 1967? So I found that I couldn't really describe what it was like to watch him in 1967, except to say, I'm going to tell you something he didn't do. And what he didn't do was he came up in the last game of the season. In that last game, they were down 2-0. The bases were loaded, and he hit a P right up the middle for a two-run single that tied the score. I said, obviously, a great clutch hit and a great clutch time. I said, and there was a bit of a twinge when he did that, and you said to yourself, he only singled? Geez, I thought he's in a homer. You know what I mean? And,
yeah.
And that basically sums it up, because that's the kind of stuff he had obviously been doing all year long, and especially in the last 2 weeks of the season.
Ray Sinibaldi is the author of 1967 Red Sox, The Impossible Dream Season. It was such a memorable year that we celebrate this 50th anniversary, but it really, in many ways, Ray, it changed the fortunes of Red Sox baseball, and I would say all of New England sports in these past 50 years.
Yeah, there is no doubt that the beginning of this, I guess for lack of a better phrase, the new modern era, this is the foundation upon which Red Sox Nation was built. They've never drawn less than 1 million since then. You know, it set them on a streak of success. Look where we stand now. I mean, Fenway Park has been transformed to this. So God bless John Updike, from the Lyric Bandbox to really a living museum. You know, and what the new ownership has done with it. But this is I guess in many ways, Kyle Yastrzemski was the founding father of Red Sox Nation. And I guess you might be right, Rich, making the argument that the founding father of New England sports as we have come to know it. And it's nice to see him. You know, I was at Ortiz's last regular season game last year. And when Yaz and Rice came out, Ortiz made this tremendously gesture and deference to them. And he did the kind of the Hosanna, you know what I mean? He was bowing before the gods of yesteryear. And that was, I really liked that. That was a nice gesture on behalf of Ortiz, but I think it just shows the reverence and the place that Kyle Yastrzemski holds in Red Sox history and in New England sports history as well.
Well, Ray, your book is a delight for Red Sox fans of all ages. I loved reading it and loved having you on the show to talk with us about those 67 Sox.
Well, Rich, it's a pleasure to be there, and this is something that, you know, I can tell you this. When in 2004, Rich, when that moment came, my son was away at college. My dad had passed away a few years earlier, and I went to, they have a little shrine for my dad in my house, and I went to the cabinet, and I took out Pop's ashes, and I put them on my lap, and I got my son on the phone. So for that moment when it finally had happened, and Renteria hit that ball back to Fulton, he flipped it over to Minkiewicz, and they were world champions. I wanted to make sure that everything was connected, from Pop to me, to my kid. And all of that having been said, there is nothing yet that I've experienced in my following of sports for all these years that compares to that collective joy on that day in October when they won the pennant, and absolutely nothing. So thanks to those guys, and give my best to Rico and tell him I'll see him at the plantation.
Author Ray Sinibaldi, as we wrap up the first hour of The Best of Downtown, our salute to the 1967 Red Sox. Ahead in hour number two, you'll hear from folks like Steve Buckley, Chad Finn, Mike Lowe, and former players Billy Rohr and Rico Petrocelli. This is Downtown on the Pulse, WZON.